over that time, I covered my share of disasters, and oftentimes I would turn to the DART Center for just a lot of resources, whether it be tips on covering disasters or kind of managing them, and as a reporter, just kind of how to get through them. And so then I went for my master's last year at Columbia Journalism School, and was pleasantly surprised to see Bruce had an office up there. And, you know, as I got ready to start thinking about my project, it's a 10,000-word thesis we have to do, I settled on women and disasters. And before I went out to Indonesia, I went to Bruce's office, crowded with books and papers and everything. He sat me down, and we had a real good talk about... You know, and we, you know, I think journalists, I think especially with disasters, the first thing you think about is, you know, you got to go in, you got to find a victim, or you got to find a story. And oftentimes what gets lost in that is like, well, what is the mindset of the victim, and are they ready to even have that conversation with you? And so I think one of the things that was really pleasant, one of the things that I took away and applied when I went to Indonesia was just the sensitivity, knowing when to pull back, when to give that person you're talking to a break, recognizing, you know, trauma in a lot of different ways. So anyway, back to Bruce. He's the executive director of the DART Center for Journalism and Trauma, a project of Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism, encouraging innovative reporting on violence, conflict, and tragedy worldwide. Founded in 1999, the DART Center sponsors a wide array of fellowships, awards, specific topic workshops, and research linking journalists with clinicians, researchers, and other experts in the aftermath of violence, disaster, and traumatic events. The DART Center operates satellite nodes in Europe and the Asia-Pacific region and has led programs in more than 24 countries. That explains Bruce's last trip to Australia. I'll hand it over to him, and he'll give you his thoughts on these things.
Okay. Thanks, Mike. I am really glad to be here. Nobody here is well-dressed enough to be a Baptist, so this must be SEJ. I thought I was down market as I was walking through the halls. Wow. It really is very good to be here. I, as an investigative and human rights journalist before starting the DART Center, I intersected with the work that you all do as environmental journalists from time to time. And indeed, I think probably I became a journalist at all because of Rachel Carson and her work. And it's especially nice to be here in conversation. It's also wonderful to be here because 9 years ago, what, this week probably, I flew into Baton Rouge, somehow wrangled a car, I have not quite sure why, and stopped by this little shopping mall where Mark Schlefstein and some of his colleagues at the Times-Picayune had camped out and set up a newsroom with bubblegum and scotch tape. And then I drove back into a city still filled with water and stench and worse, and found on high ground a little house where a few of Mark's colleagues at the Times-Picayune were camped out in those first days and weeks after Katrina. That trip taught me something about the meaning of natural disaster and human agency for natural disaster. It also taught me a great deal about the courage and resilience of journalists who set out to rescue the story of their community and make sure that not only the ruin but the recovery of New Orleans were covered. I finally, given our topic today, I can't help but be aware that we're here the day after the terrible news about Stephen Sotloff. And I would just say that as journalists on contentious ground that makes a lot of people hate us, we are all Stephen Sotloff, and there's a deep intersection between the kind of reporting that he did on the disaster of war and the kind of reporting that all of you do on ecological disaster. It is going to be in the background, perhaps, of what I have to say. I want to just throw some ideas out for conversation. I mostly want a conversation with you. But I want to throw out a few ideas around the idea of aftershock. and the significance of reckoning with aftershock and the aftermath of violence and trauma for us and our craft as journalists. Because I'm in a room of environmental journalists, I know I don't have to explain aftershock. I don't have to explain the idea of the Earth trying to restore itself to equilibrium after the great disruption that an earthquake is. I was in Haiti shortly after the earthquake in 2012, and a couple of things were obvious. One was that there were still, from time to time, aftershocks, which were frightening enough. But even more noticeable were the aftershocks in the minds, in the bodies of the journalists I was working with, leading workshops and covering the aftermath of disaster. We ended up not being able to hold any of them inside because the anxiety level of Haitian journalists in those first weeks was so high, even with safe buildings. We ended up having to listen over and over again as colleagues from Haiti would describe the shake of the earth, the stench of the bodies, the roar of collapsing buildings, as if it had happened just hours ago, as if it were happening for the first time. As human beings, our subjects and ourselves are in our psyches incapable of absorbing the extremity of what we often witness and experience. And that's particularly true around disaster, right? And so our minds, our bodies react to overwhelming violence, overwhelming threat, with a series of reactions, a series of typical responses that psychologists call trauma, psychological trauma or psychological injury, and which are of great consequence to how we do our jobs, how we do our reporting. We need to understand the implications of these kinds of aftershocks for our story subjects and for ourselves. And I think there's in particular a profound intersection with you as environmental journalists dealing with disaster. Back in the sort of dawn of time, it was presumed that most people's psychological problems were, as any of you who read Freud in college or after would have known, the subject, the caused by our unresolved conflicts, the fights we have with our parents, with our fantasy life, with our suppressed selves. But beginning in the Vietnam War, psychiatrists, psychologists began to observe something different. Vietnam veterans came back to this country, and perhaps because they were isolated from a society that didn't like the war and isolated from a generation of veterans who thought that the Vietnam vets were just hippie dope smokers, they began to talk amongst themselves on military bases around the country in coffee houses and rap groups. And these veterans began to identify certain problems they were having in common with one another. Difficulties concentrating, difficulties sleeping, difficulties in their relationships, difficulties holding down jobs. And they invited in a generation, really, of pioneering psychiatrists and psychologists, people like Robert J. Lifton, who had written about the atomic bombing and its effect on Hiroshima survivors, who'd written about Nazi doctors, invited Lifton in to, and others, to listen to them. And these remarkable clinicians realized that they were onto something new. Not suppressed memory from childhood enacted and reenacted in neurotic daily life, but memories of atrocity that were too big to contain. Memories of napalm, memories of mass killing, memories of profound threat and the deaths of buddies under the worst possible circumstances. And it wasn't that this was suppressed memory, it's that these memories were too big, too alive, and were intruding upon the daily lives and the daily biology of these veterans. And the psychiatrists working with these folks dubbed this post-Vietnam disorder. At roughly the same time, another group of clinicians, women, feminists, were working with sexual assault survivors and rape speakouts, domestic violence speakouts, and they too, in the late 60s, early 70s, began noticing these same patterns, these same changes, these same psychological injuries, as did a whole other group of clinicians working with Holocaust survivors, with torture survivors from Latin America, survivors of Nazi concentration camps, refugees from apartheid. They began noticing exactly the same issues. And it wasn't until 1980 that the American Psychiatric Association recognized, in one of its most innovative moments, something that today we call post-traumatic stress disorder. The idea that people can be changed from the outside. Now, I don't want to turn any of you into diagnosticians. I'm not. You shouldn't be. But we need to understand these changes if we're going to be effective, innovative journalists out there as you are interviewing the victims of disaster in the immediate aftermath or going forward, contending with our own responses to challenging assignments, and thinking about meaningful coverage ahead of, during, and in the aftermath of great catastrophes. We now know through neurology, through more and more and more research, that this initial recognition of that pioneering generation of clinicians was right. That memories of overwhelming threat are stored differently in the mind. They're stored in a kind of hot memory place where they can be quickly recalled. And this is designed for survival. If you are in the jungle, and shit, you guys are environmental journalists, some of you probably have been in the jungle and had tigers come out at you. Tiger leaps out of the bush, you want to leap. You want to remember what that tiger looks like. Your body wants to mobilize its resources and run to stay alive. But those same responses become profoundly maladaptive, are inappropriate once you're in safety. So you get the combat veteran who hears a car start or backfire and hits the ground. Or the person living alone in the woods because they can't anymore endure connections with people. That's trauma. And that's aftershock playing out. There are really three characteristic responses of people, of individuals, and then families and communities all sort of bleed together. After a tsunami, like Mike covered, after war, after Hurricane Katrina, that all play together. And before I describe this, I want to say that I was at dinner last night with a friend, another reporter here in town, who was describing himself and other friends who had been here through the storm being permanently changed, having a rainfall like we had yesterday afternoon raise his anxiety level without him almost even recognizing it. Having the air feel a certain way as it does this week. Simply having some things that will never be the same. That is trauma. And there are three basic mechanisms that have real significance for our work as reporters that I want to talk to you about. And then we'll circle around and talk about it in environmental journalism in particular. But bear with me for a minute. The first mechanism that is so characteristic of trauma, and we have seen it in our sources, and we may see it in ourselves, is what the psychologists call intrusion. Just the unwanted presence of that memory that will not go away, that is there when you don't want it, that may come in your dreams in the form of nightmares that keep you from sleeping, that may come as you're staring at a blank screen, trying to write, and the image comes at you of the lower Ninth Ward 9 years ago, of the battlefield in Syria last year, of the car accident you covered when you were 22 years old. And it's there, and you can't get rid of it, and it's in the way. Intrusive memory. It's those memories stored where they're designed to be accessible for survival, and yet they're overwhelming your mind's ability to put them where they're supposed to be. Alongside that, there's a biochemical piece, and we know this in trauma survivors. There's a sense of agitation, of being jumpy, of being what the clinicians call hyper-aroused. We've all known people, probably, who simply, we tried to interview them, and you can't hold them down. You can't keep them focused on the story. Or they may have great difficulty establishing trust and become angry with us at a moment's notice. That's hyper-arousal. Everything ramped up a little bit too high, as if they're impermanently on the fight-or-flight threshold. And then, finally, there's sort of the opposite of all those. Just as the earth tries to restore equilibrium, the mind tries to retain equilibrium in the face of these overwhelming responses, and many people become numb, become avoidant, avoid any reminder, any interaction that may arouse these other problems. And that's one of the most characteristic signs of trauma, that withdrawal or numbing, the cliche of the veteran who lives alone in the woods, the person who withdraws from friends or family. Take all three together, and you have what the psychiatrist Judy Herman calls the whipsaw of, or the dialectic of trauma, a whipsaw between being overwhelmed and obsessed and attracted by violence and a subject and the memories, and doing everything possible to avoid it, being numb, being isolated, being alone. These all together can be singularly impactful on our work as journalists. You know, we think about our sources, the people you report on. We rely on the appropriate and accurate memories of the people we interview. Intrusion becomes a really big problem. We rely on people's ability to stay focused, to interact helpfully, to build trust with us over the long haul, especially of an investigative or long-form piece. And there, that kind of characteristic agitation, the hyper-arousal, becomes a real problem. And of course, we rely on people's ability to connect to us. And there, the numbing, the isolation, the withdrawal can be crippling as we're trying to report a story. Similarly for ourselves as journalists, we rely on all of these mechanisms in ourselves. We rely on our memories. We rely on our ability to concentrate. We rely most profoundly on our ability to build trusting relationships. And if those are disrupted in ourselves by our own experience, it can have a singularly profound effect on our ability to work. I think we all know colleagues, whether doing environmental journalism or cops reporting or war reporting, who are casualties of that kind of psychological injury, who should be doing good work and aren't. Personally, I view this as a kind of censorship, as profound as throwing a journalist in prison or killing her or him. It's a kind of psychic assassination that we need to be paying attention to, because the world deprived of a journalist's effort through preventable, addressable psychological injury is deprived of that journalist as effectively and probably more cheaply than if she was killed or thrown in jail. So this is an issue of real consequence. It has particular resonance, I think. This notion of trauma and psychological injury has particular resonance as we cross into the realm of environmental reporting. And there are several reasons for that. First of all, it turns out that in public health surveys of psychological distress in the aftermath of disaster, psychological trauma is much worse, is measurably worse, when there is human agency involved. Earthquakes, hurricanes by themselves are really bad. But when human technology and human failures of leadership play a, or and human technology play a significant role in disaster, all of the markers for psychological trauma go up, and you get more enduring problems for more people. We saw this play out here in New Orleans, in which not only the disaster that Katrina represented, but the failures of leadership at every level of society except for journalism were so profound. You saw it in Chernobyl after the great disaster there. And it's one reason why as horrific as the tsunami was, while the trauma levels were as high as you would expect after a mass disaster, they were not as high as they might have been overall, because it was simply an overwhelming natural event. Human agency matters, and a lot of your work as environmental journalists involves this intersection of human agency and disaster. So when you are laying out lines of accountability for irresponsibility or abuse of power leading up to a Hurricane Katrina, when you are describing potential dangers that are preventable and may prevent a disaster in the future, you are in fact helping address and speaking to this crucial issue. So that's one important overlap, I think, with the work of environmental journalists, and one reason to be very aware of trauma. Another reason is that trauma, while we experience it as individuals, we also experience it in connection to others, in societies and in families. And indeed, in many of the parts of the world and parts of the country that you folks cover, there is what the clinicians call intergenerational trauma. Not just, and I don't mean to keep picking on New Orleans, but we are here, not Hurricane Katrina in isolation, but Hurricane Katrina as one in a series of natural disasters, Hurricane Katrina interwoven with urban violence in the street, Hurricane Katrina interwoven with other issues of poverty and violence and issues connected to that. That's a great consequence. There have been a number of studies now showing intergenerational trauma as a social phenomenon and as a scientific one. There's a woman at Mount Sinai Hospital, one of the great researchers into epidemiology of trauma, Rachel Yehuda, who has been doing a study of women who were pregnant and in the Twin Towers on 9/11 and who survived. She's been studying those women and their children, you know, who are now in their early teens, and has found in those children all of the biochemical markers for post-traumatic stress disorder. Indeed, found it at a very young age, suggesting that there were characteristic epigenetic changes that were triggered by the extraordinary horror of 9/11. That is something you are going to see in many of the populations that you are reporting on as environmental journalists, and it's something to be aware of. I also think it's of consequence for environmental journalists because there's a kind of news agenda implication in all of this. You might think of it as the Act 1 and Act 2, or Act 1, Act 2, and Act 3 of journalism. As reporters, we are mostly pretty good at covering breaking news, and that's nowhere more true than disaster. Stuff happens. I could take any of you in this room and drop you on the scene of an earthquake, a tsunami, a bushfire in Australia, and you would know what to do and would do a thoughtful, sensitive, effective job of finding stuff out and telling people about it. And that's Act One journalism, trauma as it happens. We know how to do that. Our tradition as journalists has been to put breaking news about disaster on the front page. That's always been the tradition of journalism. But then there's and we know this in New York, we know this in New Orleans, we know it in Aceh, there is an Act Two of disaster, the long playing out of disaster recovery and sometimes often resilience and sometimes personal catastrophe, the people who don't make it, in the aftermath of disaster, that long Act Two. And that's where knowledge of trauma and its impact becomes valuable. If you're going to be covering the impact of a disaster, you need to be thinking not just about 6 days or 6 weeks, but 6 months, 6 years. What does it mean to children who are exposed, as some friends of mine's children were, to the burning towers of 9/11 outside their school windows? What impact does that have on their lives? Well, there's a lot of science about that. What impact does it have on residents who lose their homes in New Orleans? How does resilience work? How do people get through difficult times? There's now a lot of good, solid research on that, and a lot of it is on the DART Center website. and what are the characteristic struggles that people are going to have? And as journalists, how do we report on this? There's a wonderful study from the CDC called the Adverse Childhood Experiences Survey. Came out about 3 years ago now, and it is the first comprehensive survey of the impact of kind of multiple layers of violence and tragedy on children. And it is overwhelming in the evidence of public health impact, economic impact, psychological impact that childhood exposure to violence, threat, and stress has on developing minds. As environmental journalists, you need to know about this in order to report on the problems, report on the remedies, hold our officials accountable. And then there is also, arguably, a kind of Act 3, I think, to trauma, which is the really enduring changes in our worldview. You know, the sort of thing that Primo Levi wrote about after the Holocaust, that Elie Wiesel writes about, or that literature often captures better than we as journalists do, but is part of our job as journalists to look at how individuals, families, and communities are changed, how our own views are changed. That's important on the craft side, and it challenges us. We need to be innovative storytellers if we really want people to understand disaster and its impact. We also very much, equal innovation, need to be thinking about ourselves as journalists. Certainly when I started out in reporting, none of us thought much about the impact of covering difficult stories on ourselves, and indeed the ethic very much was suck it up. The ethic was if you're feeling distress, you shouldn't be here. We now know that's not true. We started the DART Center for Journalism and Trauma, a group of journalists, clinicians, and researchers, in 1999, because we found that as we went around talking to newsrooms about how to cover victims of violence better, someone would always hold up a hand in the back, and it was some crusty night and weekend cops reporter, when a psychiatrist is describing PTSD, and this guy would say, in every newsroom, "Hey, doc, yeah, sounds a lot like me." It turned out that until the late 90s, in the whole history of journalism and in the whole history of psychology, no one had bothered to ask, or hardly anyone bothered to ask, what is the impact on this of journalists. So we at the DART Center sponsored the first studies. There have been a number of others. Now, on our website, if you're interested in this sort of thing, there is a database a little further down there of more than 1,500 peer-reviewed scientific articles on various aspects of this all over the world. And we know that we as journalists are a resilient tribe, but we also know that we have vulnerabilities like other first responders and like soldiers. We know, for instance, that among general assignment reporters in this country, post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms and other kinds of psychological injury are as prevalent as they would be with cops and firefighters, depending on the study, between 6 and 13%. We know that people who cover war repeatedly show rates of post-traumatic stress disorder of 28%, rates of depression of 21%, substance abuse 14%, radically underreported in my estimation, and that this parallels soldiers. Now, and, you know, it makes sense. And we now know there's actually a very important new study out just in the last few weeks, that newsroom professionals who deal with a lot of traumatic user-generated content are also experiencing an association with vicarious trauma, with symptoms of PTSD, symptoms of depression and anxiety. The work that we do, and particularly for you folks as environmental journalists, the work that we do exposes us to a lot of toxic imagery, a lot of toxic information, even if you are not front lines. There is a very well-established phenomenon in the psychological literature called vicarious traumatization, or secondary trauma. It says that people who, in our vocations, are exposed to overwhelming barrages of traumatic information and imagery are capable, very vulnerable, to traumatic symptoms. This was observed first in clinicians, psychiatrists, psychologists, then cops, human rights investigators, it's true of journalists as well. And indeed, it's so prevalent and important an issue for us as investigative reporters, as researchers, as book writers. It's so important. The new diagnosis, the new Diagnostic and Statistical Manual that the American Psychiatric Association puts out has a brand new peer-reviewed definition for post-traumatic stress disorder. And for the first time, it includes a paragraph that recognizes vicarious trauma in people who are exposed to traumatic imagery in their vocational role. So we are on the charts now of science. This is a very important thing. We need to be aware of this. We especially need to be aware that avoiding this subject, avoiding the question of the impact of covering trauma on journalists, not only does us no good, it is actively destructive. All the literature says that the single biggest source of resilience in the face of trauma is social connectedness, is being in touch with others. Much more important than clinical professionals, drugs, or anything else you can come up with, is simple social connection. And the single biggest predictor of long-term psychological injury is isolation. That is front to back, worldwide, interculturally, in every kind of study that's ever been done. And that shows up in the literature on journalists as well. It's crucial. And number two, we know that of all of the various kinds of distress in that Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, post-traumatic stress disorder and related psychological injuries are, if left unaddressed, some of the most enduring and damaging. And if addressed, if treated, are among the most successfully treatable, among the most successfully adaptable. We need to recognize this. We need to recognize it because ourselves and our colleagues are at risk of not being able to do our jobs, and it's wholly unnecessary. There are ways of maintaining resilience on difficult stories, and we have tip sheets on all this sort of stuff on the DART Center website. I also think there's an even deeper level on which thinking about trauma and thinking about environmental journalism fit together. And that has to do with abuses of power. The sort of early psychiatrists and psychologists who looked at trauma, people like Robert J. Lifton, whom I mentioned, or Judith Lewis Herman in Boston, any of this kind of great generation that discovered this, understood trauma to be about losing power, losing status, becoming completely at the whim of a violent actor, whether it's a general leading you into battle, or the earth simply pulling the ground out from under you, or corrupt politicians not doing what they can do to help a city stay safe. These are abuses of power. And when abuses of power are involved, again, all of those hallmarks of trauma become far worse and off the charts. And indeed, psychologists now have a term, moral injury, to describe what happens when the social contract is broken, the deal we have with our own societies to stay safe. I think that is nowhere more important and powerful than on the ground of environmental issues and climate change, where the social contract is at risk of being broken in the most profound way, where people are at risk of contending with trauma amplified by official neglect and abuse. This has a profound ethical dimension. It also has a dimension for our own reporting. When we go out and do our work, it turns out there now have been some studies showing that ethical journalism practice in the face of trauma protects us psychologically. And unethical reporting can be quite damaging and amplify the effect of traumatic exposure. Some of you may have been aware of the Utøya Island shootings in Norway 3 summers ago. Dreadful experience. Because it was the middle of the summer, many of the reporters who responded were very young. Trainees, cadets, interns, while the more senior reporters in the room were off in their summer homes somewhere in Norway. a journalist and a psychologist together did a study of these guys, of these reporters, and found a couple of years later that those experiencing the greatest ongoing distress were also those who felt they had committed ethical breaches in their reporting, who felt that their reporting did more harm than good, who felt they were pressured into interview tactics that they didn't approve of or had published images they wish they hadn't published. So, and this again parallels what we have found from cops and soldiers and others, that a sense of mission and ethical practice and purpose, underlying purpose, again, as environmental journalists, something you all have, is quite protective. We need to know that. It's part of our contract with ourselves, part of our contract with viewers, readers, and downloaders. I think we need to pay attention to that. And to circle back to Rachel Carson, if you think about this idea of you know, abuse of power, you know, it was in fact Rachel Carson, I'm just going to read something, who in Silent Spring writes this, and she could have been talking about violence and disaster. In fact, she's talking about poisonings. She says, in each of these situations, one turns away to ponder the question, who has made the decision that sets in motion these chains of poisoning, this ever-widening wave of death that spreads out like ripples when a pebble is dropped into a still pond? And then she goes on to say, the decision is that of the authoritarian, temporarily entrusted by power. He has made it during a moment of inattention by millions, to whom beauty and the ordered world of nature still have a meaning that is deep and imperative. The authoritarian, temporarily entrusted with power, a moment of inattention by millions. This sounds exactly like what you all are trying to call attention to. It sounds exactly like the perpetrators of violence in Syria, in Gaza, wherever you want to pick, in Mexico, in the world today. It sounds like the attacks on journalists around the world, which are at a higher level than they have ever been. It sounds like a lot of the issues that we deal with. And we need to understand that when we're dealing with environmental reporting, and in particular when we're dealing with the immediate, midterm, and long-term impact of trauma on individuals and communities, and the impact of trauma and safety and psychological injury on ourselves as journalists, there too we are fighting against abuses of power. And this can give some shape and purpose to reporting in what can otherwise be some pretty overwhelming situations when we're dealing with aftermath and aftershock. I'm in danger of blowing more smoke than I can possibly defend, so I think I will hold it there and maybe just have a conversation. Mike, do you want to start something?
Yeah, sure. I have a couple questions, but does anyone out there have questions? Well, maybe you can start. Yeah.
One, a little bit before one, and we're going to go to 1:15.
Kathy Florsheim, Rhode Island freelance photographer. Where in the process of the trauma do you have to intercede before it's too late, or is it ever too late to get a response that's positive?
Good question. And are you thinking of kind of journalists in distress or Pete?
Both.
So, it is never too late. There's a whole subspecialty of geriatric trauma shrinks who are dealing with, you know, World War II veterans, for instance, who are still committing suicide at a much higher rate than men who were not veterans their same age, right? So their peers. So everything that you see in Iraq vets, you also see in World War II vets. And there, it is possible to intervene after all that time and still help. That said, the literature also all says sooner rather than later. Because what you're really dealing with is the biological over-consolidation of traumatic memory and traumatic responses. Every time you get a trigger event and it sets off that little neurotransmitter rush, it sets in motion a kind of biological dialectic of being overwhelmed and then of pushing the other way and being avoidant, and it locks you into a kind of spin cycle. The more times that happens, the more challenging it is. So early intervention is important. That said, I also should point out that if you were to look on a sort of a chart, you would find that most of us will experience trauma symptomology like I described in the first 3 or 6 weeks after an overwhelming event. And it's the science says that after a single event, a car accident, a plane crash, or whatever it is, most people will calm down most of the time, will settle down, and it's, depending on the nature of the event, some percentage that will show persistent difficulties. On the other hand, that percentage tends to remain persistent if untreated over time. And it may be, if it's a very bad earthquake, 20%. If it's a single crime, it may be 10%, or could be more if it's a big war. But you'll see people go kind of like, the number goes like this, 60, 70% all showing trauma symptoms for the first few weeks. After a month, it's down maybe to 20%, and then after 6 or 8 weeks, it's down like this, and then it levels out. So it's about the over-consolidation of memory, and you want to interrupt that at the sort of 1 or 2 month point, ideally, if you think someone's distressed. You don't want to presume someone's distressed in the first few weeks. The psychiatrists talk about watchful waiting as the healthy response. And look, you don't, as colleagues, I need to say this, we don't try to diagnose. All we do is look for changes. We say, is my colleague no longer meeting deadline? Am I not sleeping in ways that I used to not sleep? And has this been going on for a while? Right? Am I kicking the cat more often than usual? All that sort of thing. You look for changes, and similarly if we're dealing with colleagues.
Yep. One quick thing. Before I forget, is there anybody in here who's a real AV expert, audiovisual expert? We have our audios running on pilot, autopilot. I don't know if you want to babysit it, Bill, because Karen had to do it.
Jan Spiegel, Connecticut Mirror. This is kind of two-pronged. Mm-hmm. How do you differentiate kind of what trauma to look for in some cases? You know, do you know, if it's a natural disaster, is it going to be the disaster itself, that it happens again, that you're going to be broke, that you might get sick or something like that? You know, that's part of the question. The other question is, this is sort of maybe reversed, but on some levels, do you want trauma to stick around so people don't forget and don't go back into complacency, which is, you know, frankly, what we along the shoreline see up in my neck of the woods, and people forget, and they forget quickly. So it's kind of two pieces. Thanks.
Right. I should say that I'm a Connecticut coastal resident. I live in New Haven. So, so the point is not forgetting. We don't want people to forget. As journalists, that would be irresponsible. In fact, we stand for memory. I can't remember who it was who said that the most radical idea in America is the long memory, right? In fact, part of the problem of trauma is that very often memory gets suppressed as part of the avoidance, right? So it's not about memory. It's about overwhelming reactiveness, memory that's too big to contain, that gets in the way of daily life. Our job as journalists isn't to make a clinical assessment of that. On the question of what's the trigger, clinicians now are grappling with what they call complex PTSD, which is to say the reality that most people bring histories of trauma at one point or another in their lives to encounters with big disasters and big events. And you're going to react, everyone reacts differently, depending in part on the trauma load that you already bear. People who've experienced child abuse or family violence, for example, are at higher risk of PTSD after a single big traumatic event. That doesn't mean you shouldn't cover those stories, and it doesn't mean that people who experience these things will automatically end up more screwed up, but it means the risk is greater, right? And it's something to be aware of. Similarly, people who've been sexually assaulted, that's a real huge, overwhelming trauma. The rate of PTSD is very high, and in turn, it's associated with the PTSD from later events. These things interact with one another in a very complicated way. I think it's safe to say that there's a lot of literature saying that events in which people feel a loss of control are likely to be traumatic, and that's one of the things that clinicians will ask in initial interviews with people. Did you feel like you lost control? That's associated with psychological injury. Severity of trauma, again, sexual assault, certain kinds of threat are exceptionally profound. Stuff like that all have an impact. And there's some good fact sheets on the DART Center website that could illuminate this a little further.
Yeah, Adam Glenn. Oh, sorry. Along these same lines, but as a reporter talking to victims of trauma, the same issue. And the ethical dimension comes in, too, because, of course, we want to know their story, but are we, in effect, risking their psychological well-being by having them relive, perhaps repeatedly or at length, the details of their trauma? And how do you deal with that?
This is a huge question, and I will say at the outset that there is... First of all, I think there's a lot of interesting craft dimensions to interviewing people who've been through trauma, a way of listening that's a little bit different, where we have to put our presumptions aside and remember that if loss of control is the hallmark of trauma, we can make an interview a very ratifying place by finding ways to give people a lot of control over the interview, making sure that they understand that why they're there, making sure that there's choice involved, right? Ethical interviewing can make it into a better event. Secondly, we shouldn't confuse distress with long-term injury. Someone may get very distressed at recalling a terrible event. That doesn't mean that we're making things worse for them. And indeed, sometimes the distress is something they need us to be able to handle, to bear. As a Holocaust survivor once said to me, hey, this happened to me. If I can say it, you can hear it. Right? Scientifically, there's no good study that I know of the impact of journalistic interviewing on traumatized subjects. And I invite anyone who is doing a PhD in this room to do it. We need the study being done. That said, there is a lot of evidence from science, because at universities, as I'm sure most of you know, you now have ethical review boards, and you have to determine that there's no injury from studies. So what we know from scientific interviewing of trauma survivors is that short-term distress indeed may go up. There can be associated with retelling these events, but that there's no evidence of long-term psychological injury. Our interviews are not causing people to experience traumatic symptoms they would not otherwise have. What I think may make things worse, to turn back to that sort of ethical dimension, is if people feel ripped off or betrayed by a reporter. If they tell us the story and we don't use it and haven't told them, we might not use it. Or if we use it in a way that doesn't represent them accurately, or if we make factual errors, even small factual errors, that may tap into a deep vein of betrayal and may, if not prolong recovery, certainly create churning distress and bring those feelings of betrayal and lack of safety up to the surface in a very active way. That's how I would think about it.
Just to follow up, but just before that, I mean, in terms of, you know, when you're going into a situation, though, is there, and you know you're going to be, like, anniversary of the tsunami or something, and you know you're going to be coming upon most people who have been affected in some way, how do you prepare yourself? Are the things, like we talked about before I went, I mean, are the things mentally you should be thinking about, things to do, not to do, almost a kind of a mental checklist to kind of, so you don't exasperate or you don't make things worse?
Right. Well, I think, first of all, to have a kind of interview plan rather than to wing it is a good idea, because you're dealing with the most important experiences of people's lives, and you want to show the respect of preparing. I think that's important. Secondly, to be thinking about how am I going to give people a sense of control over these interviews. I think that's important. Letting people choose the place, or if they want someone with them, things that we wouldn't do for an interview with someone who has a lot of power. I think it's important to understand that people who have lost their community or home in a disaster or experienced catastrophic trauma, whatever their original status, have been deprived of existential power. The world is no longer a safe place for them. So our job is to kind of build that bridge back a little bit for purposes of the interview. I think that's important. Also, to avoid telling people what they think, that's always a good interview rule, but it becomes a matter of high stakes fundamental trust with disaster victims, trauma victims. Certainly the stupid "how did that make you feel" question, for which the only response is either silence or "how the fuck do you think it makes me feel?" I once asked actually a great trauma psychologist about this. I said, "Okay, I get that I'm not supposed to say how do you feel, and I get that I'm not supposed to ask stupid stuff, but what should I be asking people, trauma victims?" This is from a woman, this is a great clinician named Lorianne Perlman, who has worked both in Rwanda with genocide survivors and in Hartford, Connecticut with sexual assault survivors, and as a pioneer in the field. And she said, just ask, what happened to you? What happened to you? And it sounds simple, but actually that formulation of an event coming from the outside, what happened to you, rather than anything that might imply blame, responsibility, forgetfulness, or anything else, is the best door opener. And if you use that as your pathway, and what happened then, and what happened then, you will get the story in a far more profound way than if you think you're pulling on the heartstrings. The gentleman in blue here has been desperate.
Tony Davis from Tucson. Two things, hopefully quickly. You said that a lot of time, that typically the symptoms, the long-term symptoms of being in a traumatic event don't appear in the first 4 to 5 to 6 weeks. So that probably argues journalistically really well for making sure that you got to wait for a while and come back to the story. You don't just hit it immediately. You're really going to see what the impacts are if you wait longer. That's a given, right?
Oh, I think there's no question. But that, I mean, I didn't exactly mean that symptoms may not appear for 6 weeks. That is true, but it is also true that people who seem really out of kilter in the first month may be fine. They may just sort of settle down. So both things are true. Yes, that kind of midterm ground, really beginning a month or more after a catastrophic event, is when you are going to begin seeing the long-term psychological responses that people have. I think that is very much the case.
In the Southwest and in the West, where I live, the biggest disaster we're having is not a short-term, a hurricane, a flood, a tsunami, it's the drought, particularly in California, but it's starting to hit Arizona and other places. And the question I have is, are the ground rules and the impacts any different in a slow-moving disaster, as Pat Mulroy of Nevada has called it, versus an immediate disaster?
Good question, and I'm not sure I know, but I'll try. I think the key issue is not speed, but is something a one-time event or a sense of chronic crisis and threat. So, for example, in communities that are afflicted with chronic violence, whether it's in Syria now or northern Mexico, you don't see a lot of things like PTSD. There is no post. The threat is ongoing. Instead, you see high levels of anxiety. You see depression. You see people becoming isolated from one another and fragmented in particular ways. And I suspect that the long-term environmental catastrophe you're describing, the drought that plays out over an extended period, will have that kind of an impact, that you will see psychological responses that are more akin to people in societies in chronic crisis, because it doesn't end, there's no safety, we don't know where it's really going. If you're a landowner, a farmer, someone who worries about these things, your level of kind of existential threat is going to be constant, as if someone is ringing you every day and saying, we're going to take your land away from you. So my guess is that you see more of that sort of chronic stress, the stuff that's associated with chronic stress and threat, rather than what's associated with safety following overwhelming catastrophe.
And even in these kinds of long-term ecological, big long-term farm crises, states set up mental health helplines because you see a lot of suicide and that kind of thing among farmers. I'm going to try and spread the questions around, people who haven't had a chance to ask questions. We've got about 5 minutes left. Anybody who hasn't asked a question yet this morning that has one? Okay, go ahead, Saul. Oh, wait a minute. You've had a question already. Go ahead.
Sure. Hi, Bruce. I wanted to talk about reliability in interviewing. I would really encourage that manual on ethical journalism and interviewing after trauma. After Katrina and then after also the BP oil spill, you interview people who are saying things that you know cannot be true and are not true as part of their narrative. And so how to process that? You don't want to discredit this person. I think something like the levees were blown up, I saw them be blown up. I think your points on long-standing disenfranchisement and kind of a building up of collective trauma over time have a lot to do with those kinds of things. But in that moment when you're interviewing that person and they're saying something that you know is not factual or what do you do with that? You obviously don't want to interrupt the interview and say, wrong.
You don't want to call bullpucky on that. Right.
And the documenting of that over time, I mean, the story of the trauma becoming a story, that this is that something has become a narrative that people are repeating is interesting. But in that breaking news situation, or even as we approach the anniversary of the storm, those situations.
So I would say to that, this is where our job and our responsibility as professional journalists is in fact to take what people say but then verify it. I mean, and in some ways the stakes in verification become even higher with disaster and trauma than in other circumstances because the emotional valence is so high and people's need to create a narrative in which the incomprehensible becomes a little more controllable and comprehensible is so great that it can lead to false narratives, and false narratives lead to bad policy, right? So it's important to get it right. I think in the interview, what psychologists would say probably is you need to accept the kind of narrative truth of the moment for the individual you're interviewing. It's how they see it. It's how they experience the event. It's how they've made sense of it in their mind. That doesn't mean that you just put it out there in an unjudgmental way. It does mean that in the course of the interview, you'd have to listen respectfully. If you're going to challenge someone's narrative directly in print, you would owe it to them to be in touch and say so. But I think in the course of an interview, you have as much to learn from how people put a story together and the metaphors and language and explanations they use to make sense of it as you do from the who said what to whom. Facts, it's not that facts are easy. But stories and facts aren't the same thing, and we can learn from stories even when we know that the evidence may lead us elsewhere. Does that make sense?
It does. I guess the question is then, do you discount that source altogether? If certain, the narratives don't match up in certain parts, what do you do with that?
I think it depends on the individual. I think that there are some people who are basically reliable narrators, but who plug a rumor.
I'm gonna jump in right here. That's kind of a basic reporting 101 question that will come up throughout the.
Well, it's a reporting 101 question, but it's a very subtle one.
Okay.
Because you have in fact, part of the nature of I mentioned the sort of the overconsolidation of memory, and part of what happens is that if you witness a horrifying event, and then begin to process it, and if you have something wrong, that wrong fact becomes part of the story in a very enduring way. It's not just that somebody's making stuff up. It's that something they saw, their senses are altered, you absorb information in a different way sometimes when you're witnessing things, or you hear something at a moment of great distress, and it just becomes part of the story. That's fundamental to understanding how overwhelming experience affects people. And the fact that the levees were blown up, for instance,
is something that people believe, is important to understand and know. Why do so many people, why are so many people still members of the Grassy Knoll fan club, despite the overwhelming, and I apologize to anyone in this room who is, but in spite of the overwhelming evidence around Lee Harvey Oswald and President Kennedy's assassination? It makes the world a more comprehensible place. It takes that sense of the social contract being radically disrupted and helps, at least if some version of the CIA, Castro, and the mafia acting together kill this guy, it makes much more sense than a lone psychopath. And similarly with the kind of situation you're describing.
And I apologize. Really, you'll hear me throughout the day kind of trying to make sure we get back on topic, but I see very well now how that's relevant, so thank you. Yeah. Okay.
Saul Trenis from Toronto. There's a celebrated case. I come from Canada, and there's a celebrated case of post-traumatic stress disorder up there, Romeo Dallaire.
Indeed. General Dallaire is one of the great people who put himself out there after Rwanda as bared his own PTSD.
Well, and that's exactly where it goes from a point of view of a journalist. That experience of not being able to control the events that happened in Rwanda, despite the position that he held as general at the United Nations team in there, led him to write books like They Fight Like Soldiers, They Die Like Children, or Shake Hands with the Devil. And in a sense, yes, it's his own autobiography, very much, but it's also a kind of a journalistic exercise, and I think that to some extent journalism is a way out. And I wanted to sort of take that thought, and I want your reaction, that in a sense it's all shades of gray. He's an example that's at the extreme, perhaps, but there's also, I think, a little post-traumatic stress disorder in pretty well everybody. And I think that as journalists it's really worth noting that, like, for instance, when you're covering oil pipeline issues with the oil sands, you know, and you're dealing with somebody whose farm is being taken over or being expropriated, that there's probably a little PTSD going on in there, and that might explain some of the behavior or in protesters. I'm just wondering your thoughts about that, about the sort of shades of gray.
Well, there certainly are, and if this is why I think it's important to think about trauma not just as post-traumatic stress disorder and not just as a diagnosis, but as a set of psychological injuries that exist on a spectrum and which sometimes play together in a comprehensive and overwhelming way and sometimes are evident one at a time or as little tripwires in an interview or a story. I think it's far more important for us as journalists to see that spectrum of responses rather than it's all PTSD. The part of me that works with clinicians and researchers says we need to proceed on an evidence basis and say PTSD is PTSD for very specific reasons and not be too casual in our usage. But to understand that what leads to that, the set of vulnerabilities that accompany loss of control, that accompany threat, that accompany attack, those are pretty universal and are things we're going to encounter over and over again. I also think, apropos General Dallaire, I do think that telling a story is protective and a source of resilience. And indeed, the studies that have been done of journalists suggest that. Why aren't our rates of PTSD higher? Because we get to frame the story. There's some pretty good evidence that visual journalists, photographers, and videographers have higher rates of PTSD than pen and pencil journalists. And that is partly because they're up closer to stuff, partly because they're processing images over and over again, and partly because they don't always get to make stories out of it, which restores a kind of control. I think as environmental journalists, you're very often dealing with catastrophes on a level for which there will never be legal justice, but there can be a kind of narrative justice, and in doing the work that you do, you're being instruments of narrative justice. I think that's a profoundly important social role and is closely tied to trauma.
Okay, thank you very much. This has been a great session. We're out of time now, and we'll start back here in about 10 minutes, and Mike's going to close us out. We'll start back in about 10 or 15 minutes.
Great. Thanks, Bruce. That was great. Thanks for sharing with us. And if you guys want any more, his website is?
Yes. www.dartcenter.org. And I wanted to give two quick ads. One is we have tons of tip sheets, resources, all kinds of stuff that are deeply embedded in the site despite our crappy search engine. And if you can't find something, email me. I forgot my cards, but it's just Bruce.Shapiro at Dart Center. Mike knows how to find me. Secondly, we have an annual fellowship program, the Dart Center Ochberg Fellows Program, which is a week-long seminar in New York City in January with about 15 other reporters, top trauma clinicians, about everything from trauma science to storytelling and everything in between. I would love to see some applicants from SEJ get some environmental journalists into the mix in the Ochberg Fellowship. That's on the website under fellowships or under programs, and there's also a story on in the carousel on the homepage.
And don't forget the awards.
And yes, thank you. Yes, the DART Awards open at the end of December for work in the calendar year preceding. Brings a nice fat cash prize, and we give that out at Columbia every year. Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks, everyone.
All right, thanks.